Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. When you think of a so-called company town today, you might think of the Googleplex in Mountain View, California, or Nike's headquarters in Beaverton, Oregon. They're self-sufficient communities and almost many cities that are like vibrant symbols of American industry. But there are also company towns like the meatpacking plants scattered throughout the heartland where injuries run high and the pay runs low. Company towns have a rich history in Massachusetts, especially in the old mill capitals of Lowell and Lawrence. Those cities feature prominently in a new book called The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy. I recently spoke with the book's author, Hardy Green, and asked him to describe the stereotypical company town.
Well, I think there is a kind of a negative past image that's associated with the phrase. It's a lot of the worst attributes that really did exist, and they still do exist in some places, where there would be company-owned housing, where all the institutions in town would really be owned and operated by the company. A town like Annapolis, North Carolina, a textile town, was created by the company, and all the institutions there, from the YMCA to the schools to the hospital, were created and basically owned by the company. Housing was also created and owned by the company, and you would pay rent to the company for the house you lived in.
And ostensibly, were these sometimes started because it was supposed to be for the betterment of employees, we're going to give you housing, but in fact it was a way to just squeeze every penny out of them, including when they bought their groceries and so forth?
Yes, I want to say yes to some degree, because there also were towns where the purpose was always very idealistic. And so, in the book, I referred to both sort of satanic mills and industrial Edens. There are places like Hershey, Pennsylvania, for example, where the company owned the housing. The housing was rented to the workers who lived there, but it was very nice housing. The indoor plumbing, electricity, central heating, you know, the town was landscaped by the company. There were public institutions from libraries to hospitals.
You write that many companies viewed them as social experiments. I mean, they wanted these sort of corporate utopias, similar to some people having set up utopian living situations. What was their motivation for doing that?
I think there's a kind of a twofold motivation. There sometimes was a kind of a religious motivation or a desire to create a utopian environment. And I think, you know, I write in the book about Edward Bellamy's book, Looking Backward, and how influential that was in the late 19th and early 20th century. I think that some capitalists were influenced by that kind of thinking too, the idea of social betterment, and they wanted to be part of that. On the nickels and dimes level, oftentimes places would be in remote locations and they would need to encourage a stable workforce there. Generally, having a stable, skilled workforce was a motivation for many companies, and it still is in a place like Corning, New York. Last summer, I spoke to a former CEO of Corning. Well, you guys probably know him. His name is James Houghton, and he's on the board at Harvard. And he said they've done a lot for the town of Corning. They've sort of rebuilt a town after a flood in the 1970s. They funded a lot of enterprise there. And he said to me, we don't do any of this out of some generosity. We're really doing it in a way to try and encourage a stable, skilled workforce. We're sort of competing with workers, for workers with Silicon Valley, and people who we want to come work here might very well say, why should I live there? And so they want to create a kind of ideal environment.
When you think of the key historic company towns, I wonder what come to your mind. I certainly think of Hershey, Pennsylvania, the chocolate company, Gary, Indiana, steel. What do you think are the other big company towns?
Well, I start the book off with Lowell. Lowell was sort of the first large industrial experiment in America, and so it was sort of a model that many companies looked at for years.
And this was a town started by Francis Cabot Lowell. And you write that he had been to Manchester, England, which was a famous textile company town in England, and he was just appalled by the conditions there, that the air was terrible, they were beggars and thieves, and he decided that my mill will not be like that.
This is not long after the creation of the American Republic, and I think men like this, we often think of capitalists as being sort of grasping and, you know, thinking only about their own bottom line, but I think that they felt that they were building the nation, and they didn't want America to be like the sort of hellholes that they'd seen in England. But it's also the case that they had to be concerned about the workforce. They didn't have a large workforce to draw upon.
There's a section in your book where you write about how the founders of the mills there wanted these to be upright places that were going to be good moral places for young women to work. Hardy Green, would you read this section? It talks about how these companies felt almost a responsibility to the families of these young female workers to give them an upright workplace.
Sure. The older women who served as boarding house keepers provided supervision and made sure the girls were in by 10 p.m. The presence of such cultural totems as pianos and libraries reassured families that, as management often stated, they were not surrendering their daughters to a lifetime of toil. No, whatever time elapsed in Lowell was more akin to a period of preparation for later life, perhaps even for marriage. Lowell would not threaten middle-class aspirations. The girls could read and discuss the latest literature and poetry, even write their own compositions, continue their musical studies, and come of age in refined surroundings. Circulars that survive suggest a lively intellectual and cultural scene, with elevated amusements including lectures by such luminaries as Ralph Waldo Emerson. In a society given over to the headlong pursuit of wealth, 19th century American women were required to become counterbalancing agents of culture and moral sensitivity. Lowell would help them fulfill those roles.
It sounded like things were pretty decent for the people who worked there. They lived in boarding houses run by these stern matrons who made sure the girls were in by 10 o'clock at night. They had libraries. They had lectures by people like Ralph Waldo Emerson. On the other hand, there was this letter you came across by a Lowell mill girl saying, "I won't stay here and be a white slave." Although in the
right.
end, she decides, if I have to work, I guess this is the best of the worst.
Well, it's bound to have been a severe shock to come from living with your parents and living on a farm and bucolic surroundings to being in this very busy, very urban kind of place. To put it mildly, there were mixed feelings. But, you know, that ideal period didn't really last that long in Lowell. And one of the things that happened is that they kept building more and more textile towns. So that by mid-century, they're getting towards having a kind of overcapacity in the textile industry, and there were, you know, accompanying wage cuts and cuts in the lifestyle that the workers could live.
And you write that the original Lowell experiment did die, and in fact, so many of these company towns die. I mean, Detroit is dying. I mean, so many other communities that used to be built around these companies. Is there a formula for what kills these company towns?
Well, I think you have to put this in context also is, how long does any company really last? I have been on a number of radio shows where there are callers, and callers are calling in to lament deindustrialization of America. And it's true that people are still very upset about this. And I think a lot of Americans today don't really see, well, what's going to happen next? Where will the next round of growth come from? But it's rare for a company to really last more than 100 years. You know, when they built Lowell, you can go up there and see these wonderful brick buildings. They clearly intended this to last and last.
But when a company dies today, it doesn't necessarily kill the town that it's in. And these companies, when they died, or these mills, when they closed, they killed the town.
Right. It is not unusual for the town to die as well. I mean, here's another town, Newton, Iowa, which is where the Maytag company was located. And Maytag has, in recent years, been taken over by Whirlpool. It was a prosperous company that provided, you know, a good living for many years there. And the future for Newton is really uncertain. Even in Hershey, where they've just announced that they're closing the historic plant on Chocolate Avenue, people are upset about that. And Hershey has moved in recent years more and more toward a kind of a tourist economy. Many people have been to Hershey Park, which is this Disneyland-like area there. So it has more of a tourist orientation, and not every place can move to that. Obviously, Gary, Indiana can't become a tourist destination. But, you know, these towns do feel it when companies close.
One of the things you write that killed the company towns were that as all these young sort of native milkmaids, as you call them, that were recruited from the farms to work, were replaced by Irish immigrants, it seemed like the paternalism toward the workers eroded. There wasn't such a commitment to keeping good living quality for Irish immigrants as there was to the milkmaids. Was that a factor?
Well, let's not restrict ourselves to talking about New England. I mean, if you look across America, that kind of paternalistic instinct appears over and over. So I was just recently out in Washington State and went to a town called Port Gamble, which is an old logging town, a beautiful area. But these kind of logging towns, they might initially draw only an all-male workforce, but they were vulnerable. And they told me there that one of the things that happened at the end of the 19th century was the Alaskan Gold Rush, and that was pulling all these young male workers away from them. So they wanted to build a town that would attract families. So Port Gamble, for example, had these very nice houses that were built by the company. They had schools and churches, all the kind of ingredients that you would want to attract a workforce, a family, and a stable workforce. And so that appears as a regular phenomenon as well, that you know, you want to have a stable workforce, you have to provide some kind of incentive.
Hardy Green, what do you consider the major company towns today?
Well, Hershey has become more of a kind of a tourist destination, but it still is very much a Hershey town. I don't want to sound ominous, under the control of Hershey, even though the largest employer there now is a hospital. There are towns across the Midwest, and we haven't even touched on these, the meatpacking towns that are controlled by companies. And this is a very kind of grim development where there's a huge turnover. They attract a Latino workforce, and people are kind of used up. The work is very dangerous. There's a lot of repetitive motion injuries. They really have a kind of a almost captive workforce that are really low paid and oftentimes living in trailer parks because they're so poorly paid. So those are places very much in conflict, I think, with the land of liberty.
What is it in your mind that determines whether these company towns turn into an industrial Eden, as you call them, or a satanic mill? Is it about the workers, the type of business, the owners? What are the determiners?
There does seem to be an industry-by-industry kind of demarcation. That is, it's very hard to find in the history of American coal towns any place that was really kind of a model town. I mean, some of these towns, like Jenkins, Kentucky, were larger and fairly well-appointed. But the kind of attributes where the workers are really almost treated like prisoners tends to be consistent within that industry. And from out of nowhere, these timber towns up in the Northwest have a more paternalistic attitude. And it does seem to be that this is not highly skilled labor. Timber is very hard. It's very difficult and hard labor. And so why did they decide to take a more paternalistic attitude? So the attitude in some industries was much more, we have to imprison this group of workers and hold them here. And in other places, it's the attitude is much more, you know, that will rely on carrots to encourage the workers to do a good job and to stay here. And it does seem to vary a lot from industry to industry.
I was going to ask if you thought that the dirtier and harder and more physically demanding the work, the less likely the factory was to be a kindly company town. But as you just said, the timber industry was more paternalistic, and that's hard, physically demanding work.
Yeah, it doesn't seem necessarily to be the case. And another thing you might think is that profitability is key here. If a company is doing very well, like they were in the early days of Lowell, then they can afford to sort of share the largesse with the workers. But I don't think that's ultimately determinative either, that there are places where they're not, you know, making huge amounts of money, but they do have a more benevolent attitude toward the workers. Another of these timber towns is a place called Scotia, California, which is in Humboldt County in Northern California. And that, too, is this kind of a model, beautiful little town where the company for years was run by a family called the Murphy family. And they said, yeah, we're a paternalistic company. Why? Why were they? Well, it's partly just that's what they wanted to be.
So in that sense, it sounds like when a founder dies, often that dream could die with them.
That's certainly true. You know, Hershey has become much more like a kind of a modern corporation. For so many years, the personality of that company was determined by Milton Hershey, the paterfamilias of the company. And I think after Milton Hershey died, there was a feeling that it was very hard for the company to make a lot of decisions, particularly in regard to the town itself. What would Milton want to do, they would, I think, often ask. And Or there would be a feeling that, well, Milton wouldn't have wanted it that way. And so that has been a theme.
Hardy Green, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Hardy Green is the author of Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy.